Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Identifying people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts and then supporting them is crucial in the prevention of suicide. Danny Leedy was 33 years old with plans to help others who struggled with suicide ideation. Then she took her own life. Her parents, Jeff and Donna Heck, created the nonprofit 33 Forever to carry on her mission. Suicide is a sensitive topic. As a reminder, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. Joining us is Donna Heck, co-founder and board president of 33 Forever. Donna, welcome to the show, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Can you tell us a little bit about Danny's story and why this matters?
Well, thank you for having me and being able to share. Danny, as you said, she had a long battle with depression from the age of 15 on, had attempted to take her life at 15 and 22. 22 was very, very serious, and we didn't know if she would make it. And at that point, she took charge of her mental health and went through a serious inpatient, a lot of counseling, medication. And about a year to a year and a half later, she felt that she was good, knew she needed meds, took care of herself. Fast forward a few years, and she was running a company. She had 250 of 300 employees that were under her. She owned part of the company. She lived on Capitol Hill. She had every outward appearance of financial wellness, BMW. Inside, she was still battling. But I tell you, the awareness wasn't there as much anymore since it had been 11 years. And then one night, like a perfect storm, 6 weeks after her and Jeff, her stepdad, were trying to put together a plan for her to go speak about mental health and depression, something happened, and we lost her that night in February of 2019. And we knew that that could not be her legacy because she had way too much to give and just wanted to help people struggling.
I'm so sorry. Here was somebody who was so aware of the issues and the struggle.
Yes, absolutely. She knew everything that needed to be done. She did self-care. She had yoga. She had a yoga instructor come to her house. She did medication, counseling. She actually helped so many other people that at the time of her passing, we think her resilience bucket was completely gone. She was helping her her friends who were struggling, and she was last on the list. We didn't see it coming. We thought her mental health was under control, but apparently, it was still plan B is what her doctor thought was happening.
How is 33 Forever carrying on Danny's dream of helping people with mental illness and suicidal thoughts?
Well, we have actually, we've done a lot of, we started it within a week of losing her, not knowing what we would do with it. And in the 3.5 years, we've raised over $600,000. We've started an endowment at Ohio State University for the Behavioral Health and Media Care Clinic. We've done a lot of things locally. We have done fundraisers. We've given people access to resources on our page and sent them to the professionals like Ohio State, locally, Akron Children's Hospital. And we are just trying to help people end the stigma. And if they need help, just send them in the direction that they need to go.
Joining us now is clinical psychologist Craig Bryan. He's director of the Suicide Prevention Program at Ohio State. Okay. I guess he's not joining us right now. What does it say, do you think, Donna Heck, that people, even people like Danny, who worked so hard and wanted to help so many others and still wasn't safe? I mean, the insidiousness of this, right?
It is. The saddest part of it all is we are doing our best to try to help people. But Danny, Danny lost her battle. And if we can help prevent people from going through that, that's what we want to do. And perhaps know the early signs or get the treatment. I know Dr. Bryan has so much new upcoming treatment that will help people tremendously.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And I'm talking with Donna Heck. She's board president of 33 Forever. That's a man's a Mansfield, Ohio-based mental health nonprofit created 3.5 years ago in memory of Danny Leedy. I mean, she was 33 years old with plans to help others who struggled with suicide ideation, and then she took her own life. Her mother, Donna Heck, is carrying on the mission. Joining us now is clinical psychologist Craig Bryan. He's a director of the Suicide Prevention Program at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center and the OSU College of Medicine. He's a recent study found that at-risk gun owners are less likely to be detected by mental health screening tools. Welcome to the show, Craig Bryan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What are mental health screenings? What do they even involve?
Yeah, they can involve a number of different things, one of which is asking people about some key symptoms or problems that are highly indicative of, you know, mental health conditions like depression or anxiety, but also specific to suicide risk. A very common approach for screening is to ask people if they're experiencing thoughts about suicide or if they're wishing that they were dead.
It seems like such a simple question in a way. Is it always a simple answer, Craig?
No, it's not a simple answer, and that's, you know, a big focus of our research. I do think there oftentimes is this sort of kind of assumption that it's a yes-no answer, and oftentimes we kind of ask the question in that way, are you having these thoughts? But what we're learning in our research is that suicidal thoughts are actually quite complex, and different people have different types of suicidal thoughts. So it's such that the yes-no questions that many of us have been taught to ask about perhaps don't actually apply to everyone, because that's not how they're experiencing these high-risk thought processes.
How did Danny experience it, or did that change over time, Donna Heck?
It did. It changed over time. When she was 15 to probably 23, she was angry, outwardly miserable. Had a very, very low self-image. She was absolutely beautiful, did not see that, had a lot of body image issues, self-harm, and she just felt less than, I think is the best way to put it. And then after so much treatment and getting into the, you know, she had some PTSD issues that she really needed to deal with and got a handle on that in her 20s. So after that, she had promised us she would never do it again. She goes, you know, what you think of in your teens and 20s is not what's going to happen when you're older, because you realize these feelings will pass. So again, it was different. And then at that moment, you know, I wish I could, you know, if she could have gotten past it, she would be here to tell you.
And what do we know about that, Craig Bryan, how the ideation changes over time or can change over time?
Yeah, so I one of the things that I think stands out that Donna was describing for Danny is a sort of like extreme negative self-perception. And this is one of the areas of research that our team has been focused on for the past decade or so, that these very sort of negative perspectives, I'm worthless, I'm no good, nobody cares about me, I can't take this anymore, no one can help me solve my problems. We've actually found that those are thought processes that indicate sort of this sort of vulnerability to suicide. And in many cases, we're finding they're often better indicators of vulnerability than the classic sort of thoughts about death and suicide. And so we've really been looking at how we might be able to better advance suicide prevention by considering a much broader range of thought processes.
Right. Not focusing on are you or are you not considering suicide, but how do you feel about yourself? And that kind of extrapolates to the value you have for yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's this sort of, you know, almost like a kind of like a self-hatred in some respects, but the sense of like, I'm not good enough, there's something wrong with me. And I think on top of that, there's oftentimes this urgency, like I need to do something about it now. I can't take this anymore. And that's in many ways what I sometimes refer to as the coded language of suicide. It's not the S word, right? But we're finding that a lot of people, when they have these thought processes, when they say these things, usually things are not going very well for them. And that might be sort of an alert for us to check in with someone and see what we can do to help.
The idea that I'm just tired. I'm tired of doing this.
There's what I've sometimes referred to as like the exhaustion model.
Yeah.
And some of our research in the past several years has really been looking at the sort of time course of change process of suicidal ideation. And again, in Dani's case, you kind of hear how over the course of her life, from a teenager to early adulthood, the nature of her thoughts changed. And what we're seeing now is that there's a subgroup of people who in many respects kind of like experience suicidal thoughts like a roller coaster. It's ups and downs, you get better, then it's worse. It's this fluctuating process. And what that means is there's sometimes an unpredictability. You don't know what tomorrow's going to hold. You don't know if it'll be a good day or a bad day. And that's exhausting. You know, it wears people down. And so it's not necessarily always the case that it's this like kind of discrete thing that happened that pushed someone towards suicide. For some people, it's more of this kind of ongoing process that, is just tiring.
And then I'm thinking about how Donna described Dani as somebody who was so engaged in her mission as a young adult. She was just 33, that maybe she was putting out too much, and maybe she was that she was exhausting herself kind of in that way.
I agree with that. And especially after listening to Dr. Brian, that's exactly what we saw happen. She had a really good mask that she wore all the time. So she would say she's happy. She had the right answers. Even when she was hospitalized at 15 and 22, she knew what to say to get out and get on with her life. So I know she was just tired. And like he said, she just didn't want to deal with tomorrow.
Firearms are the most common method of suicide, yet gun owners are less likely to be identified by mental health screening tools. Craig, that's something that you found in a recent study. Why is this?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the sort of mysteries, so to speak, of suicide prevention for many decades is this kind of persistent finding that around half of those who die by suicide deny suicidal thoughts. Or never report anything. And the classic way of thinking about this is that, well, people are just concealing their thoughts. They're hiding it from others. And I think there are some people who absolutely do that. But where we're heading now, what we're starting to understand is that there's another subgroup who just aren't having these types of thoughts. And they're experiencing these very rapid intensification and risk. They go from reasonably okay to incredibly high risk in attempting suicide very fast, sometimes within a few hours. And this seems to be an issue of particular concern for firearm owners. And it's because ready, convenient access to loaded weapons means that those sudden spikes in risk that come sometimes unexpectedly now become very dangerous when you have easy access to a highly lethal method. And so as a result, asking many firearm owners, are you having thoughts about suicide, things like that, doesn't necessarily align with their experience. And so as a result, we often miss many people because we're thinking about it in the wrong way and we're asking the wrong questions.
What is manifesting when something happens that quickly? They're reasonably okay, and then sometimes in a matter of hours, they're attempting suicide. I mean, is that a depression? Is that something else that we need to understand?
So it's something else. Yeah, no, I think that's a great question because for many, many decades, I would still say today the prevailing perspective of suicide is caused by depression and mental illness. And that's certainly the case for many people who die by suicide, but not everyone. Actually, more than half of those who die by suicide do not have a mental health diagnosis. And I think the way to understand this is that most of us have experienced these sudden changes in our lives where we acted rashly or we made a choice that we later regretted and we said, oh, that was so out of character. What was I thinking? And so it's actually kind of a normal human experience to have these sudden shifts in our emotional states. And the same process we think happens with suicide. And so again, when that sudden shift involves, I don't want to live anymore, and we throw on top of that easy access to a highly lethal method, the result is death. And it can happen even to those without depression and mental health conditions.
You know, we're talking about mental health screening. How does anybody, I'm not even sure I've ever been screened for mental health. I don't know. I mean, outside of, say, maybe seeing a counselor, you know, and obviously doing, you know, seeing somebody, but how do mental health screenings get assigned? When do you know you're doing one? And you got to be missing a lot of people.
Yeah, this is sort of an area of debate right now, is what are the best ways to screen? How should we screen? And there's increasing discussion. Well, what are the possible risks of screening? What happens if someone screens positive? And so where I think most people are most likely to experience mental health screening is actually when they visit their healthcare provider, like a family physician, primary care doctor. If you've ever, you know, usually it's kind of like once a year is the minimum that it often happens, but sometimes you're asked questions when you go into those doctor's appointments on, you know, have you been feeling sad, down, or depressed? Have you been finding it hard to feel good or to enjoy things? Those are common ways to screen for depression. And there might be other questions that you're asked as well about, you find that you worry a lot or that you're on edge and restless. Those are typical screening questions for anxiety-related problems. So it might be, yeah, that it's sort of happening and it just doesn't stand out because we're not saying, do you have a depressive disorder? But we're asking more about what are you experiencing in your life that might signal for further assessment and evaluation.
What is it about us? I know I have to let you go, Craig Bryant, but what is it about us that wants to hide, or even subliminally, I guess, wants to hide? Maybe we're not even conscious of it. Is it simply stigma?
So the research, actually some new research has given us an answer to that. The number one reason that people don't report suicidal thoughts or mental health problems is because they want to handle it on their own. They say, I got this. I can take care of this. And I don't want to bother other people with it. Another common reason, particularly in healthcare settings, is worry about how their healthcare provider is going to respond. You know, if I say that I'm thinking about suicide, are they going to hospitalize me? Are they going to call the police? Are they going to lock me up? What's going to happen? And so a big part of our effort now is really working with healthcare providers and helping them understand that how you react to a patient's self-disclosure makes an enormous difference. And so I think kind of the key part, at least here in Central Ohio, that we're working on at Ohio State is really setting up treatment programs so that there's a place to go for people, which then I think helps to make people a little more confident disclosing when they're having those thoughts, because they know that there are effective treatments available.
And I wonder about Dani Donna Heck, and whether she had made such a success of her life and maybe kind of fearing that she didn't want to lose that credibility that she'd taken so much time to build up over the years.
You know, that's a possibility. I don't, you know, I wish
I shouldn't. I shouldn't. I should not. I apologize. I shouldn't.
No, you're fine.
Speculate on.
It is speculation, but you know, was it just a moment, like Dr. Bryan said, that she had, you know, she was moving, she had to pack her things, she had lost her best friend who moved away. There were a lot of things, and I'm sure she just said, "I'm tired, I'm done," and that was that. You know, obviously.
Oops, I think we've lost Donna Heck. Donna, we've lost you now, but I just want to say thank you so much for sharing Dani's story. Donna Heck is the board president of 33 Forever. It's a Mansfield, Ohio-based mental health nonprofit established in memory of her daughter, Dani Leedy, who is 33 years old, with plans to help others who struggle with suicide ideation when she took her own life. Also, Craig Bryan, professor of psychiatry at Ohio State University's College of Medicine, serves as the director of the school's suicide prevention program. Dr. Bryan, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. E-cigarettes can help some people kick their reliance on cigarettes, but these devices have risks of their own. The FDA last week ordered Juul to stop selling e-cigarettes on the U.S. market, citing insufficient and conflicting data from the company about potentially harmful chemicals that could leach out of Juul's e-liquid pods. Cliff Douglas directs the University of Michigan Tobacco Research Network. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's great to be here.
So from where you sit, is this a setback, all things being equal, or have you had your own issues with the e-cigarette boom?
It's potentially a setback. We have to see what the courts say now that it's in litigation, and we also have to see what the Food and Drug Administration ultimately determines based on whether a court asks it to review it further, et cetera. What we do know is that e-cigarettes on what's called the continuum of risk, in other words, looking at the relative risk of different nicotine and tobacco products, are substantially less harmful, less risky than combustible tobacco products, which are responsible for virtually all of the 480,000 estimated deaths that we experience each year in the United States from using tobacco.
That's everything from emphysema to lung cancer.
There are 15 or more types of cancer. Smoking all by itself is responsible for roughly 30% of all cancer deaths in this country. And it is globally the leading preventable cause of death.
There's been conflicts over the issue of nicotine in Juul, and the fact that, and not just Juul, but in any number of e-cigarette brands, that they actually boost the amount of nicotine, and that people are more addicted than ever to nicotine, even though they're not using the combustible cigarettes to consume it.
Well, it's interesting. Let's talk about nicotine for a moment, because it's one of the subjects of the greatest misperceptions among the public, and in fact, among the medical community as well, surveys have shown. Nicotine fuels the epidemic of smoking-related illness because it causes dependency, because it's addictive. It's highly addictive. Back in 1988, in the first Surgeon General's report to cover this issue, they compared it to the addictions caused by heroin and cocaine. But that's particularly true in combusted products. It doesn't work exactly the same way in all products. At the same time, and this is where misunderstanding occurs, it does not cause the illnesses that smokers suffer from smoking cigarettes, okay, or cigars or other combustible products. So that when it's used in non-combustible, non-burned products, it will have that drug impact, but it is not going to cause the diseases that smoking does.
Does it cause other diseases? I just want to be clear. I mean, is it associated with other issues?
Sure. It's a great question. Sometimes folks will compare it to caffeine, and I have to say that's not exactly right. First of all, it's sort of a moral question, if you will, regarding whether addiction itself is a health issue. Mm-hmm. No one likes to have to use something if it's against their will. It can increase pulse rate. It can increase blood pressure a bit. It's not entirely benign. But it, again, will not cause cancer. It's not responsible for the half million or so deaths that smoking will cause. So that gets back to that issue of what's called the continuum of risk, of relative risk. And the area of harm reduction, which can be controversial, but it's a widely accepted public health approach. For example, people addicted to opioids, to heroin, who are given methadone. Methadone is not safe, but if they can't quit everything altogether, it makes it a dramatically less risky endeavor for them.
I quit smoking, 1986, thanks to Smoke Stoppers, which came out of the University of Michigan back in the 80s.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah, behavior modification. And I wonder, though, what I would have done if I could have chosen an e-cigarette, and how that matters.
Sure. Well, here's the situation. That's a very good question, because on that continuum of risk, you'll have, Marlboro, Newport, Camel, Winston, and the like at the far end of harm. All the way at the other end are those FDA-approved medications like nicotine gum and nicotine patch, and there's also an inhaler. And those are approved as safe and effective. And by the way, it highlights the fact that nicotine itself cannot be terrible for you, or they could not call it safe for use in medication, mm-hmm. right? Now, in the spectrum between those two extremes lie other products, certain types of smokeless tobacco, e-cigarettes, for example, there are lozenges and pouches and the like. A lot of smokers, unfortunately, too many smokers, do not succeed by using the medications that FDA approves. They want to quit, or maybe they just don't want to quit nicotine altogether. And what's happened is that some millions of adults have found e-cigarettes to provide that alternative that works for them. And some studies have shown that e-cigarettes have more appeal because they mimic the act of smoking more closely, right? Even though it's not smoke, it's an aerosol, and is more helpful to some folks. So Juul, which we'll probably talk a little bit more about, for example, has provided data showing that roughly 2 million smokers in the United States have switched off of cigarettes with the aid of Juul. And since half of long-term smokers die from smoking, that potentially could save as much as 1 million lives based on what's already occurred. So that's the sort of larger public health perspective that we're trying to articulate.
Juul's the company under fire right now. It's not the most popular on the market. Why is the FDA focusing on Juul?
Well, Juul became kind of the poster child for bad conduct a few years ago. They were accused of making their products through marketing appealing to young people, even underage youth. And if they did that, and it looks like they probably did, it was highly inappropriate. But part of the result of that was that in 2018, we saw a spike in popularity of e-cigarettes, particularly Juul, among kids. That raised concern for all of us. In fact, at the time, I was the National Vice President for Tobacco Control for the American Cancer Society, and we were leading efforts to address those concerns. But what's happened in more recent years is that the company really reformulated, from all appearances, its business model. It stopped all of that marketing. It stopped using flavors that were alleged to be of interest to kids, limited their products to the so-called tobacco flavor and menthol alone, and really became in this industry, from all appearances, again, I'm not inside the company, have no connection to any of these companies, a more responsible actor. And the bottom line right now, when it comes to the concern about kids, which, look, I have a 19-year-old, and by the way, he is vaping right now, and that's a real concern to me, I want you to know. So it's personal. At the same time, 0.06% of youth today have used a Juul in the last 30 days. So it's becoming almost non-existent. It's clearly not fashionable among young people now. So we're really looking at the issue around adults and what they need to help themselves.
That's a really quick turnaround, which lends credence to the concern about the flavored e-cigarettes then.
Well, that's right. You know, flavors are of great concern. And the Congress back in 2009, when they gave the FDA authority to regulate tobacco products for the first time, something that we had worked on for many, many years, they banned all flavors in cigarettes except for menthol. That was a highly controversial issue. But now, as I think many folks know, the FDA is seeking to ban menthol cigarettes. And this will be a process that takes a few years and we'll face litigation, but that's something that we certainly favor. But flavors do appeal to kids. They're used to entice them in the first place. But the thing to keep in mind that too often gets lost in the sort of this polarized debate is that many, many adult smokers who switch to e-cigarettes consistently testify to the important role that flavors play for them. And I think we should honor that. We should at least acknowledge that that's a very real consideration in the larger public health picture.
When the FDA ordered Juul to stop selling e-cigarettes on the U.S. market last week, it cited insufficient and conflicting data from the company about potentially harmful chemicals that could leach out of Juul's e-liquid pods. what is Juul? I mean, why would, why isn't Juul? I mean, I know you can't speak for the company, but what's your understanding about why the company doesn't respond to these requests for data?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting thing because, first of all, it's important. It's important for any listeners who are e-cigarette users or considering using them. They're smokers and looking for an option that, that can help them. The FDA has already authorized as being, according to their statutory language, appropriate for the protection of public health, 23 different e-cigarette products that can legally be sold on the market and are available. What distinguishes Juul is hard to say, but I can tell you that that Juul, in its court filings, has made clear to the courts that it supplied 125,000 pages of data and analysis, and it included 110 scientific studies. And while one can look at those with some degree of skepticism because they came from the company, it suggests that they provided a lot of data. And the regulatory process is opaque. It's deliberately opaque to protect proprietary information. And we actually don't know much in the way of the specifics about what FDA is concerned about there.
Nicotine, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but it does not occur naturally in tobacco, right?
Well, nicotine does occur naturally in tobacco. It's an interesting thing. It's actually a pesticide. It's a natural pesticide that occurs okay. in the tobacco leaf and some other. You'll find trace amounts in tomatoes, in fact, and it's sort of a defense mechanism. But nicotine is also manipulated by the companies, the manufacturers, you know, to deliver certain amounts and that kind of thing.
And so they increase the amount of nicotine in cigarettes over the years to make them more addictive. In a separate move, the FDA is working to ban nicotine in traditional cigarettes. What are your thoughts about that and, you know, your expectations for success in that regard?
Well, you know, in a slightly self-aggrandizing note, I was actually the first person to propose the potential for removing nicotine from cigarettes to render them non-addictive. And it goes back to about 1992. I've been doing this for a little while. And the reason is that, as a senior scientist at Philip Morris said as long ago as 1972, this was a direct quote, "Without nicotine, there is no smoking." And that was, of course, in a secret document that didn't emerge until the 1990s. But the bottom line is that the vast majority of people who smoke say that they would like to quit. And it's enormously difficult because while it's not impossible, they do have autonomy. They can stop, at least in many cases, with a lot of hard work and repeat efforts. It does take away some of the choice involved. And the cigarette companies ensure that by manipulating their products chemically, not only addictive levels of nicotine, but adding other chemicals that act synergistically with nicotine to enhance the addiction, they reduced and in some cases removed consumer choice. And so that's what the FDA is trying to address here now. But the important thing is to then provide options, other ways of getting, you know, safe or reasonably safe ways to use nicotine in the event that smokers are compelled to not use addictive cigarettes any longer.
Cliff Douglas, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate the time as well.
Cliff Douglas is a professor of public health at the University of Michigan. He's director of the university's Tobacco Research Network. We have just a bit more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Men.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Men tend to be less socialized to befriend other men and form meaningful relationships with them. And the issue has worsened, apparently. A 2021 study by the Survey Center on American Life found that the percentage of men with at least six close friends fell by half since 1990. Seattle producer-designer Weston Carnes observed this among male friends in his own life. That was the impetus for his development of a card game to help men open up. Weston Carnes, welcome to the show.
Hello. How's it going, Ann?
Good, thank you. The card game is titled Let's Get Real, Bro. What's the object of the game?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think you spoke a bit to it there, but the object is ultimately to have more deeper, meaningful conversations as a means to promote connection, support, mental health. Yeah.
And so how did you devise the game? I mean, how did you design the game? What kind of research did you do to figure out what you could, how you could make this better?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm a product designer coming from like the digital space. So I have this kind of framework of design thinking, you know, which allows you to pretty, you know, put in these questions of, you know, problems that you want to solve and think strategically of how to come to a particular solution. I was inspired by some of these other conversational card games out there. And, you know, as I was exploring more of like the men's work world and just seeing some of what you're speaking to, these like statistics and of loneliness, kind of increasing suicide rates, really feeling like the lack of deep connection was a huge part of that. You know, like speaking from my own experience, coming from a place of a lot of social anxiety when I was younger, a lot of isolation, and the impacts of that on my own well-being, right? And kind of coming to a place now where I have more supportive, deeper relationships that just add a lot of resilience and meaning to my life. And so I've just kind of tuned into that world of men and guys and just kind of seen the landscape of them a little bit more broadly and just thought, you know, how could you create something that feels a little bit more accessible and fun, right? Like, I think that's the hard part, right? It's like, how do you create something that feels really accessible, right? And that to me was the challenge. And that's where the branding and the language and everything comes into play.
Was it designed to be played only among men?
Yeah. It's not. So I actually have the game with me here. There's a little sticker up here. So it says geared for guys, playable by all.
Okay.
Yeah. So I really did want it to be, you know, like during the kind of exploration of creating it, you know, there'd be plenty of people that would be like, you know, why is it for guys? Like, I don't think this should be for guys, you know? And I considered, you know, should it really specifically be calling out men with inside of it? And I felt like it was essential. Like it kind of like, that's really why I created this, was like an invitation for guys to be like, okay, you know, maybe I do want deeper connection in my life. Maybe I do want to be closer with the friends in my life. It's a scary, vulnerable act in many ways to buy this game and to play it. But I think that's where I'm at, like, that's where I'm asking, like that is part of the game itself,
right? It's
just the vulnerability
to play it
in
the first place. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Where is growing up as a male in this society, what do you think is happening that it seems like we're so much more aware of this difference in genders and how they relate to each other within the genders. Where do you think this comes from, that boys and then men have a tough time making those deeper connections?
Yeah, totally. You know, honestly, I don't know the answer to that, right? I can only make my own like hypotheses of my own experience, right? And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the nature versus nurture conversation, I think is an important one. But I mean, my own views is like, it's both of those things, right? Like I think the cultural context of like conversation and connection is important, right? Like you see girls way more commonly creating social structures, like bonding on a conversational level, right? The way in which boys connect is so different. And you can say like, yeah, culture impacts that, but I do think there's something that's a part of us. And so how do we cultivate and strengthen the muscles that maybe are not necessarily are atrophied or not strengthened over time?
Well, atrophy is a good word because I was kind of stunned by that 2021 study that I cited by the Survey Center on American Life that found the percentage of men with at least 6 close friends fell by half since 1990. Even as we become more aware of this issue, we fall farther and farther behind. I say we as a society.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I remember seeing that study, and it was like, you know, the number of people who have one or less or one or fewer, you know, doubled. And that's when it's like, okay, when you get to zero, that's not good.
No.
Right? Like that's a scary place to be. But yeah, there's so much changing in our culture now. And I like the internet, I think, plays a part of this, right? Like we live more transient lives in some ways. It's easier for us to engage in our own world and feel satisfied to a certain extent, but it may not necessarily mean the type of connection that you really want. Yeah.
I was interested that you went the route of a card game, a non-digital manifestation
totally.
Of this, right?
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, I think maybe we could just talk about the card game and how it works. And you said it's one of those conversation games, like, what are we talking about? Like everything from categories to I don't know what kind of games you're comparing it to.
Yeah, well, the I don't know if you saw the website. The main kind of tagline is Cards Against Humanity Meets Your Therapist.
Yeah, okay.
And that usually like creates some, you know, emotional, you know, bringing that to the market. You see people's face, see that, and it's always some either degree of like funny, disgust, cringe. Like there's all sorts of really good responses. But yeah, the game is very simple, and there's a reason I use
the Cards Against Humanity.
It uses that kind of game mechanic, where you ask a question or a prompt, and then people respond, and then you give the card to the person whose answer speaks to you the most. That's kind of the language I use, right? In Cards Against Humanity, it's kind of like your favorite one, but the language is very delicately placed, right? Like there's actually not even the word winning is not used in the instructions. And so like, it is a game. And I do think people are going to play it competitively if they so choose, right? I think that is a part of like, yeah, the world of games and also the world of men. But the invitation is really more around, kind of like getting real, so to speak.
And something that you said at the beginning about problem solving, that's kind of the thrust of a lot of these questions is how would you solve this problem?
Yeah, I can read some of the questions if you'd like. So I'm opening one right now because I realized I didn't have the one I used to have.
So you're not playing this every night at home with your friends or?
I'm not, no. I've definitely played it recently, but I'm not doing it every night, you know, especially when you're the creator of the game. I think there's something to like, you can only, it's like a musician being like, are you listening to your album every night? It's like, so the game is very simple. There's three levels. Can I swear on this program?
Just because I'm not sure if it'll pass muster.
Sure. So there's three levels. There's level one, kind of real. There's level two, pretty real. And then there's level three, super beepin' real.
Stinkin' real. All right, okay.
And yeah, so there's 30 kind of prompts at each level there.
Okay.
And they're all, you know, like they're all designed to kind of instigate some, I mean, humor's a part of it, but also to instigate like inquiry within the self of like, all right, where am I at? How am I doing? What's going on? What do I care about in life? What are my values? And then also to create connection, right? And so I think when you have those deeper conversations, the connection usually just follows, right? But like, I can read a few. This is level one, kind of real. What's one thing you now realize you may never outgrow? Ooh. What's the furthest you've ever gone in the name of love, a crush, or getting laid? What's the dumbest thing you did when you were younger? So those are level ones, and they kind of get progressively more real. You know, if I were to read a couple of the level threes, what would be / are your hangups as a father? What's what's the first thing you feel / think when you hear the term male privilege? In what situations do you often find yourself most resistant? What are you afraid might happen if you stop resisting? So they do get pretty real. What's the most challenging thing you're dealing with right now?
Have you watched people, besides, obviously you've played it with people, but when you're not playing it with people, have you observed people playing it in the testing phase?
Definitely.
Yeah.
So the initial, like, I think I got like 20 or 30 groups before I made the final print, because I had done a test print, got it out in the world, and, you know, used all my design research skills to collect some feedback. But yeah, I think it was really neat to see, right? Like, there's a lot of context in which the game can be played to a certain extent, right? It can just be a one-on-one thing. Like, I've heard of people using it on a road trip, kind of just like having questions to ask. I've seen larger groups play where it's like a little bit more of like a party-esque game. The core, like, I would say the ideal is probably like 3 to 5 people. I've seen like families play. There've been some really like beautiful conversations that take place there around like family and like, and parents and whatnot. It's been a really cool experience just getting, learning how people are finding the game, how they're playing it, and what they're getting out of it. You know, I'm really trying to have those conversations with people that get it and just be like, what did you hope to get out of the game? And did you find that, you know?
What kind of feedback have you gotten from professionals in the field of, say, mental health or men's health?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, even in the testing and iterating process of the cards themselves, I brought in a couple people who with mental health backgrounds and just made sure that the cards themselves were within a domain of like safe, you know, like making sure that the container is safe. It's been really neat. Like, we have a partnership now with BetterHelp. So each game comes with a free month of therapy. And that's really like to just continue the exploration of, you know, the conversations that take place and really hopefully promoting like self-growth, a desire to look deeply within and ultimately feel more comfortable sharing that content, right? Because I do think in many ways we all struggle with the same stuff, you know, like, and I think that's to me, like the value I found in these group conversations, like these men's groups that I have participated in. It's like, when we actually share some of this like harder content or like scarier content, we see that like, we're not alone in it. And that can provide a lot of just a sense of like, well-being, you know, because to be alone in your struggle is so much harder than to be with others.
Weston Carnes, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. It's lovely to chat.
You bet. Weston Carnes is the creator of Let's Get Real, Bro. It's a card game designed to support men's mental health through connection and conversation. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff as well. Senior producer Marcus Charleston, assistant producer Bobby Gerberich, assistant intern producers Evan Clark, Brody Saravelli, and Molly Teller, with video production by the Ohio Channel and board operation by Bobby Gerberich. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.